Thank you for inviting me. I was asked to talk generally about the conflict, and I will talk, give a sort of a general outline of the conflict since its beginning until today, and then talk more particularly about one or two aspects of the conflict. The conflict between the Zionist movement and the Arab world is over the territory of Palestine or the land of Israel. It began with the immigration of Zionist settlers, immigrants and settlers to Palestine in the early 1880s by Jews who felt that and knew or believed that Palestine, the land of Israel, was their ancient homeland. They came from the Tsarist Empire, the Russian Empire, and in the 1880s there were pogroms in the Russian Empire, which essentially, within 30 years, a series of pogroms, sent many or most of the Jews who lived in the territory of the empire to America, to Canada, to the British dominions, Britain, 2 million of them. Something like 60,000 Jews believed in Zionism and decided not to go to the Americas or to the West, but came to Palestine in a trickle over 1882 to 1914. And the Arabs growingly became politically conscious, the Arabs of Palestine, and then growingly, as their consciousness or nationalist consciousness developed, they began to resist the influx of Jews, Zionists. And thus the conflict began. Some people say, no Zionism, no Arab-Israeli conflict, which is of course true. One can also say no Arabs, no, in Palestine, no Arab-Israeli conflict. The Arabs, incidentally, who talk about themselves as the indigenous population of Palestine, are not really indigenous. They came to Palestine, conquered it, and began to settle and Muslimize it in the 7th century. They came out of Arabia. They never lived in Palestine. But as I say, they came and conquered it. And from that point on, Palestine became a largely Arab, largely Muslim country. The Zionists came there from the 1880s and began to Judaize, if you like, the country. Thus the conflict began. If you like, one can say no Arabs conquering and settling in Palestine. No conflict, of course. In any event, the conflict now is 140 years old, and I would like to periodize it, to divide into three, I think, historical stages. I think this would be accurate. The first period is from 1882 until 1948, and that was a conflict between Palestine's Arabs, the Arabs who lived in Palestine, who later began to call themselves, incidentally, Palestinians. Before 48, everybody living in Palestine was a Palestinian. They had a Palestinian identity card given to them by the British Mandate government, Arabs and Jews. But after 48, they began to call themselves the Arabs a Palestinian. And during that period, 1882 to 1948, there was this gradually growing clash between the Arabs of Palestine and the Zionist immigrants who came and settled there and established settlements there. Both of the peoples, both the Jews in Palestine and the Arabs in Palestine, claimed the land as their own. And I would say the Arabs of Palestine to this day claim the land as their own and don't want to share it with the Jews or anybody else. This is their land, and the Jews they saw as robbers coming to steal an Arab land, to steal their land. That's how they saw it. The Jews wanted all of Palestine from the inception of the Zionist movement until, I would say, the mid-1930s, until 1937-38, when the Jews reluctantly agreed that Palestine had to be, not because they wanted to, but had to be divided between the Jews and the Arabs. Because of The Arab Revolt, which occurred during the mid-1930s, 36, 39, because of the international circumstances which necessitated the creation of a safe haven for the Jews of Europe who were being persecuted by anti-Semites, eventually by the Germans. They needed a safe haven, and so the Jews reluctantly agreed, okay, we'll get a safe haven, but we are willing to make do with at least part of Palestine as a Jewish state, instead of their original dream of having all of the land of Israel, which they believed was theirs, as a Jewish state. The Arabs of Palestine from 1920 indulged in a series of collective bouts of violence against the Jewish settlers, 1920, 1921, 1929, and then 1936-39. And as their political consciousness grew, so the bouts of violence each time were bigger. And the biggest bout of violence, of course, occurred in 1947-48, when the Palestine Arabs attacked the Jewish community in Palestine. In fact, a day after the United Nations General Assembly, the 29th of November, 47, decided on partition of Palestine between the Jews and the Arabs. Two states would be created in Palestine. That was the General Assembly's proposal. The Arabs rejected that proposal. The Jews accepted the proposal. And the Arabs the following day began shooting. And gradually their attacks on the Jews snowballed into a full-scale civil war between the Arabs living in Palestine and the Jews living in Palestine. Both of them, of course, under British rule. The British continued to rule Palestine until May 1948. They departed on the 14th of May 1948. But before that, during the civil war between the two communities, the British were nominally and in some ways practically the rulers of the land. In any case, the Arabs of Palestine assaulted the Jewish community in Palestine. Eventually, the Jewish community responded with an offensive of their own and beat the Palestinian Arab militias. Shattered Palestinian Arab society, and the Palestinian Arabs were defeated in this civil war between the two communities. Then Israel was declared itself a state on the 14th of May, 48, and the Arab state's armies invaded Palestine the following day, the 15th of May. The armies of Egypt, Syria, Jordan, and Iraq invaded the country to attack the Jewish state. We don't have their state papers. We don't know what their ultimate aim was, but we do know they wanted to harm the Jewish community and perhaps forestall the emergence of a Jewish state in Palestine, to conquer territories in Palestine for themselves. The Jordanians entered the country in order to annex it, the West Bank, basically, and take over East Jerusalem. The Egyptians wanted to annex the Negev Desert, the southern part of Palestine. The Syrians apparently wanted to conquer take over the Sea of Galilee and the area around it. Apart from all of them harming, except for the Jordanians, harming the Jewish state, perhaps defeating it. Israelis believed at the time when the Arab armies attacked that the intention of the Arab states was to destroy the Jewish community, in effect to create a second Holocaust. And this was what the Jews in Palestine believed. It may not have been the intention of the Arab states. We don't know what their full intention was. We only can judge by where their armies went, what they did, but we don't actually have their state papers to know what their ultimate objective was. But that was the feeling, the sense in the Jewish community in Palestine, that this is what the Arab states intended for the Jews of Palestine, and as I say, to destroy, if you like, the emergent Jewish state. From May 1948, that I spoke until now, really about until 14th of May, from 1882 until the 14th of May 1948, is the first period of the Arab-Israeli conflict, and that is between the Palestinian Arabs and the Jewish community in Palestine, which emerged as a state on the 15th or 14th of May, 1948. The second stage of the Arab-Israeli conflict begins on the 15th of May, 1948, with the invasion by the Arab states of Palestine, and ends in 1973. Those 25 years between May 1948 and 1973 are the period, if you like, of conventional warfare between states, between the Arab states surrounding Israel. The Palestinians have been knocked out of the fight, but the Arab states have attacked the newborn state of Israel. And from that point on, for 25 years, they're busy waging a war with ups and downs, with major bouts of violence every few years in full-scale war, but also a small-scale warfare between the surrounding states and Israel for these 25 years until 1973. And there we have, of course, the second half of the 48 war, the war between the states, and then you have a war between Israel, supported or in cooperation with Britain and France against Egypt in 1956, what's called the Sinai Campaign or the Suez-Sinai War in 1956. Then you have the Israeli-Arab conflict or war of 1967, in which Israel fought the countries, the armies of Egypt, Jordan, and Syria. And you have the last of these Arab-Israeli wars in 1973 with the Syrian-Egyptian assault on Israel in the Sinai Peninsula across the Suez Canal and in the Golan Heights, a war which was hard fought. Israel initially suffered great losses, but eventually turned the war around and won and beat the Egyptians and Syrians, forcing them to essentially reach a ceasefire. And this, in effect, marked the end of the conventional war by the Arab states around Israel against the state of Israel. It's true that in 1982, Israeli troops also fought against several Syrian divisions inside Lebanon in the invasion of Lebanon in June 1982. But essentially, the Israeli-Arab conflict between Israel and the surrounding Arab states ended in 1973. And from that point on, gradually, the Arab states around Israel withdrew from the conflict. The first, of course, were the Egyptians, and this leads to the third stage of the Arab-Israeli conflict, which begins in 1973 and ends today. We don't know how long it's going to continue, but ends, if you like, in this periodization in 2024. The Arab states after 1973 begin to withdraw from the conflict, led by Egypt, with signs ceasefire agreements, a truce, and eventually by 1979, Egypt withdraws completely from the conflict and signs a peace treaty with Israel, the first treaty between Israel and an Arab state. And from that point on, Arab states follow. As I say, they basically leave the conflict, but it takes them a long time to digest what is happening. And by 1994, the Jordanians sign a peace treaty with Israel, and in 2020 and 2021, other Arab states follow in what is called the Abraham Accords, and Israel signs peace, not peace treaties, but normalization of relations with Arab states, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan. They all follow suit, if you like, and abandon the conflict and agree that Israel must be recognized, we must deal with it, Israel is there, if you like, to stay. They do it out of the Arab states, from Sadat, president of Egypt, in 1979 onwards. The Arab states make peace with Israel, not because they like Israel, they don't become Zionists or lovers of Zion. They begin to think in terms of their own interests. And Egypt, according to Sadat, Egypt's interest is to have peace with Egypt, not to, with Israel, not to continue to have wars which cost Egypt dearly and are unsuccessful, and to continue to have wars with Israel. And the same applies to Jordan in 1994. It's true that the person who signed the peace treaty with Israel on behalf of Jordan in 1994 was Hussein, the grandson of Abdullah. Abdullah, who had fought against Israel in 1948, also really wanted peace with Israel. It never actually happened, partly because Israel wasn't as generous as maybe it should have been. It's not that clear. In trying to reach peace with Jordan, he wanted territory, he wanted a refugee return. I'll talk about the refugee problem in a second. But Israel didn't reach peace with Jordan in 1948, but it did under Hussein, the grandson of Abdullah, in 1994. He made his peace with Israel. And as I say, other Arab states, in a sense, followed in the Abraham Accords 3-4 years ago. But these states did not, as I say, make their peace with Israel out of a changed pro-Zionist perspective, but because they were looking after their own state's interests. Their interests were to have peace, it would be better for them. That's how they worked it out. The Arab peoples, if I'm already talking about this, the Arab peoples, especially those living in Egypt, but also those living in Jordan, it's not so true about the Emirates, but the Arab peoples in general didn't go along, if you like, with their governments. The governments may have signed, the regimes may have signed peace with Israel, but the Arab peoples weren't happy about these arrangements, weren't happy about this peace made with Israel. They still hated Israel. The regimes also generally didn't inculcate in their peoples a desire for peace with Israel. In the schools in Egypt, anti-Semitic, anti-Israeli tracts persisted. Attitudes persisted. The peoples didn't agree. The lawyers' associations, the medical associations in Egypt, all of them denounced the peace treaty by Sadat. But the regimes went their own way. These are not democracies. They are led by their autocracies, in which the governments decide what happens in terms of higher politics. And so the peoples were against, but the regimes made peace with Israel. I say this may not be true about the United Arab Emirates or Bahrain. I don't know what the peoples there think. They may not have any ingrained anti-Israeli attitudes. Their school systems probably don't necessarily teach a hatred of Israel or anti-Semitism. It's a different type of people. They were never involved in the war in the between Israel and the Arabs, the United Emirates, the Bahrainis, Sudan, Morocco, not really involved in the war, unlike Egypt and Jordan. So I don't know what public attitudes really are there, but in any case, they went along with it. During this third period from 74 to 24, alongside these accords between Arab regimes and the State of Israel, there was a parallel, but quite opposite, I would say, process going on among the Palestinians who lived in the West Bank, in the Gaza Strip, or as exiles elsewhere outside of Palestine. And that process was resistance, a growing resistance, what they call resistance, what Israelis were to call terrorism, a growing resistance to peace with Israel. The Palestinians wanted Palestine for themselves, back Palestine for themselves. They wanted to return their refugees, to return to their lands and homes, which had been taken from them, from which they had been uprooted in the 48 war. They wanted Israel basically no longer to exist. It's true that there was a peace process between Israel and the Palestinians in the 1990s, in which the Palestinians ostensibly, under the PLO, ostensibly accepted Israel's existence. But in reality, the PLO was thinking in terms of a two-stage strategy, in which first they would make some sort of accommodation with Israel, establish their own state in the West Bank and Gaza, and eventually use that as a base. And this is my view of it, some people don't agree with it, to destroy Israel at some second stage when they were capable. But in the 1990s, there was a peace process ongoing called the Oslo process. But that ended in 2000 when the Palestinians, if you like, in my view, showed their real colors, when Yasser Arafat came to Camp David alongside Ehud Barak under the auspices of the Americans, President Clinton. There they were offered a two-state solution, reasonable from Israel's point of view, the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem basically going for a Palestinian state. This is what the Israelis, backed by President Clinton, offered them. And they said no, Arafat said no to what was on offer. Clinton repeated the offer in December. This was in July. In December 2000, Clinton repeated this two-state offer, basically improving on the Israeli offer, his own and Israel's offer in July. Still the Palestinians in December, January, again rejected the two-state solution, and were to do the same, incidentally, in 2008 under a new Israeli prime minister, Ehud Olmert, who offered Abu Mazen, Yasser Arafat's successor as president of the Palestinian Authority, head of the PLO, was to offer them again a two-state solution, more or less on the lines of what Clinton and Barak had offered them in December, and he said no as well. To put it quite accurately, he didn't say no. The proposal was put on the table for Abbas, the successor to Arafat in 2008, and he simply walked away from it, not saying yes or no. But in effect, not saying yes meant he was saying no. And Olmert fell from power. That was the end of that proposal. Since that point on, 2009, we have Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, who opposes a two-state solution, an opposition which has been reinforced since his reassumption of power in 2 years ago with this new most right-wing government in Israel's history, a no to a two-state solution. All of the land of Israel belongs to us. Maybe we'll gradually annex it, eventually annex the West Bank. He hopes that President Trump will support Israel in the annexation of the West Bank. It may not happen, but in any case, the Israeli intention under Netanyahu and his colleagues in this right-wing government is to take hold of and make permanent the acquisition of the so-called Palestinian territories and enlarge Israel down to the River Jordan and to include the whole of the land of Israel. This third stage of the conflict has been, if you like, complicated. It's basically an Israeli-Palestinian, a return of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict since the Arab states, as I say, gradually withdrew from the conflict after 1973. The conflict again became an Israeli-Palestinian conflict from 1973 onwards, except that the Arab states, or the Palestinians more accurately, are now backed and have been backed for several decades now by Iran. Iran, if you like, has taken the place of the Palestinian states in supporting the Palestinian claim to all of the land of Israel and in supporting it in various militant ways by arming factions around the Hamas, the Hezbollah, well, Hamas, of course, is a Palestinian faction, the Hezbollah, other proxies, and by directly attacking Israel and continuing to state that its aim is the destruction of the Jewish state. That's Iranian policy as enunciated by all of Iran's leaders since Khomeini's takeover of power in 1979. That's one of their major goals, if you like, even a raison d'etre of the regime, destruction of the Jewish state, which took over Arab and Muslim, more important for them, Muslim land, which is holy and belongs to the Muslim nation, the Ummah, and must be retrieved for the Muslims. This is a major goal of Iranian policy, military and political, if you like. And in that, they are supporting the Palestinians in this, as I say, third stage of the conflict in which they are backing the Palestinians. So that's the periodization of the conflict, in my view. That's how it divides these three stages, in which the last stage is complicated. It's Palestinians against the Jewish state, but now supported by Iran and, if you like, its proxies, with Arab states having withdrawn from the conflict in effect. It's interesting, if I'll just add a footnote to that, it's interesting to note that Syria, which is in some ways a client state of Iran, hasn't joined the conflict this year. This past year, Israel has been fighting the proxies, some of them based in Syria and Iran. But Syria, the army of Syria, the regime of Syria is uninvolved. They allow the shipment of arms from Iran to the Hezbollah, shipment of arms from Iran to God knows where, through Syria. But they don't join the fight, the Syrians. Now the situation has been made complex in Syria because of an internal revolt, which has been going on for years, but now has re-erupted. But Syria hasn't joined the conflict. In other words, alongside the Arab states, Syria is not party to the conflict. It's an interesting sideline to what has been happening in the last year. But also I wanted to speak about three themes of the conflict. One relates to the nature of the Israeli-Arab conflict. More accurately, the Zionist-Arab conflict, because it begins before the State of Israel was created. The conventional view is that it's a political territorial war between two ethnic or ethnic religious, whatever you want to call them, ethnic nationalist groups, the Zionist, the Jewish movement, the Jewish national movement, the Zionists, and the Palestinian national movement over a piece of territory. It's unlike, if you like, the conventional political conflicts between states about borderlands, say about Alsace-Lorraine between Germany and France, which is about borderlands. This conflict between national groups or ethnic groups is over the whole of the land. It's over the whole of Palestine. That's what it's issue. The land of Israel, not this chunk of the land or that chunk. It's about the whole land. And the Palestinian national movement, as represented by the Hamas in recent decades, but I think also as represented by the PLO, really wants all the land because it's theirs because it was robbed from them by a bunch of European Jews. That's how they see it. And it's true that it is a conventional conflict about territory. As I say, unusual because it's about the whole of the land, not about borderlands. But it's also a religious cultural conflict. And with this, some historians disagree with me. Now, there's always been a religious element in the conflict between the two sides, partly, if you like, with ups and downs. In the 1920s and 1929, the cause of the Arab eruption, the Arab riots, if you like, the Arab pogroms against the Jews in the summer of 1929, was ostensibly about the Temple Mount. In other words, some of the leaders of the Palestinian national movement in 1929 said, the Jews are taking over the Temple Mount, want to destroy the two Arab mosques on the Temple Mount and to replace them with a Jewish temple, a third Jewish temple. And that's why we're rebelling or we're attacking the Jews in various parts of the country. In other words, there was a religious impetus there, and I think Haj Amin al-Husseini, the head of the Palestinian National Movement later, during the 30s, but who preached in the 29s and rabble-roused in the 29 to get the riots of 1929 going, he understood that to get the Arab masses in Palestine to move against the Jews, you must talk about religion. Religion is what concerns them. They really care about God, Allah. They believe in him. They believe that he has a will, that his interpretation, that is Husseini's and his colleagues' interpretation of what Allah wants is the right interpretation, and we must assault the Zionists who are taking over this Muslim, Islamic holy land. And what I'm saying is the religious element was very important in the 20s, came to the fore in 29, and has recurred ever since through the conflict. Today, of course, you see it much more clearly. The Palestinian National Movement is essentially represented by and in some ways led by the Hamas, which is a fundamentalist religious organization which preaches that Palestine, of course, is theirs and must be returned from the hands of the infidel to the Muslims where it belongs, and again, if they win, must also be converted into a Muslim Sharia-directed land, a land governed by Islamic law. And most Palestinians, incidentally, according to all opinion polls, supported the October 7th assault by the Hamas on Israel. And They have good reason, if you like, from their point of view, to hate Israel. Israel turned many of them into refugees. It took their land. It occupied them for 50 years. And occupation is no kindergarten. It's a very brutal, basically, experience. And they've been experiencing it, as they say, in the West Bank for 50 years and the Gaza Strip in various ways also for 50 years. But the main drive of the Hamas, and as understood by many Palestinians, is a religious drive. There's a religious impetus under this striving for a territory. In 1948, the war, which is the most crucial of the Israeli-Arab wars, the first and the most crucial, because that's when Israel was established, that's when the Palestinians were destroyed, if you like, as a society, that's where hundreds of thousands of them became refugees. That war, in some ways, was spearheaded by a decision by the ulama of Al-Azhar. Al-Azhar is the leading university in the Arab world, in the Sunni Arab world, the oldest, of course, in Cairo. And it's a band of theologians who run the place, the ulama, declared on the 1st of December jihad against the Jewish state. 1st of December 1947, 2 days after the United Nations General Assembly proposed partition, they declared jihad against the Jewish state to be the Zionist enterprise, which was going to turn into a Jewish state according to the UN proposals. And this call for jihad was repeated by the ulama, in other words, the main interpreters of God's will, Allah's will, in the Sunni Arab world, which is the majority of the Arab world. The Sunnis are the major component of Islam in the Arab world, the minority are Shiites. The ulama of Al-Azhar declared jihad on the 1st of December 1947, redeclared it in April 1948 as the Arab armies were beginning to think about invading Palestine on the 15th of May, and as they did, and if you like, the ulama was sort of trying to prod, especially King Farouk of Egypt, where they sat, to join the invasion, to participate in the invasion. So they declared jihad again in April 48, and they declared again jihad in December 48 at the end of the war when the Arabs had lost the war, but the jihad was again declared. In other words, with the expectation we've lost this round, we must continue the jihad after this round into a second round, a third round, whatever is necessary to overcome the Zionist presence in Palestine. So what I'm saying is, and this echo was echoed in the Arab world, the call for jihad, it didn't just come out in broadcasts from Cairo, from Al-Azhar, it was echoed around the Arab world. So there was this drive, religious drive, religious impetus, religious fuel to this assault on the Yishuv by the Palestinian Arabs, but also by the Arab states as they invaded. The Hamas, incidentally, just to add to that, if you like, a postscript, the Hamas won the only general elections ever held among the Palestinians in 2006. They won those general elections, overcoming the so-called secular PLO, Palestine Liberation Organization, or Fatah, its major component in the elections of 2006. And then, as we know, they took over the Gaza Strip in 2007, from which Israel had withdrawn its settlements and its troops in 2005. And as I say, they are the most popular party among Palestinians, not just in the Gaza Strip, in the West Bank, worldwide among Palestinian communities. They are the most popular party among the Palestinians. That's one subject, the nature of the conflict, a political conflict over territory, but also a religious, if you like, cultural conflict between two religions, or the representative of two religions, over a piece of land which certainly the Palestinians regard as holy in terms of their religion. And incidentally, the Zionist side, which didn't view the conflict as religious, not in the 1920s, not in the 30s, not in the 40s during the 48th war, but has growingly over the past two decades come to also regard, at least a large segment of the Israeli Zionist population, has come to regard the conflict as religious also, with the increase of importance and power of the religious elements in the Jewish community in Palestine, in Israel, now probably representing demographically 30% of the country, maybe slightly more than 30% demographically are religious. Zionist enterprise in 48 was probably 90%, more or less, 90% non-religious. Now it's maybe 70%, maybe a bit less non-religious, in other words, secular. Today also those 30% see the conflict as well in a religious light, see that it is also a religious conflict over territory which is holy. A second subject I wanted to talk about was refugee problems. The 48th War, unlike what most people understand or know, the 48th War created three refugee problems. The first we know of, which exists to this day, the Palestinian refugee problem. 700,000 Palestinians were uprooted from their homes during the 48th War. Most of them ended up inside Palestine in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. 30% perhaps ended up outside Palestine, and those are real refugees. The definition of refugee in the Oxford Dictionary, and probably in most places, is somebody ousted from his land, from his country. 70% of the Palestinian refugees in 1948, 70% of those 700,000 ended up in other parts of Palestine. They moved from Jaffa to the West Bank, from Jaffa to the Gaza Strip, and so on. Ended up inside Palestine. So they're not proper refugees according to any normal definition of the word refugee. 700,000 were uprooted from their homes. This certainly is true. And those 700,000 were not allowed back by Israel as a matter of policy. Israel, the Israeli government from June 48 began to resolve not to allow the refugees to return en masse to their lands and homes. And those 700,000 burgeoned into today's 6 million Palestinian refugees. They were all given the status, the 700,000 of refugees, and the international community, in the as represented in the United Nations, decided to give them refugee status down the generations, which is unique in world history. Usually refugees are German refugees from Czechoslovakia, ended up as refugees in Germany in 1945, 46. Those were refugees, were absorbed by Germany and became German citizens, no longer a German refugee problem in Europe. The same applies to Germans from Romania or Hungary or Russia or whatever. All those communities were absorbed and the refugee problem ended. The same applies to the Vietnamese during and after the Vietnamese War with America or France and America. They were absorbed in various places. No Vietnamese refugee problem exists to this day. There is a Palestinian refugee problem and there are 6 million of them on the books receiving aid, many of them or most of them, receiving aid from the international community, meaning the West is subsidizing their lives through UNRWA, with the schools, free health care, food, and so on. And that has been going on since 1948. That's the first refugee problem, the Palestinian refugee problem, which still exists among us. We can talk about it in the question and answer, if you like. It's something which I actually know something about. The second refugee problem caused by the 48 war was a Israeli refugee problem, which nobody knows about. 70,000 Jews in Palestine in 1948, in Israel, 1948, became refugees in the course of the 48 war. They were uprooted from their homes, from various kibbutzim, which were conquered by the Syrian or Egyptian army, by the Jordanian Arab Legion, which took also the Jewish quarter of the old city of Jerusalem, and their inhabitants, all of these inhabitants, 70,000 of them, became internal refugees. They moved to Tel Aviv, to Haifa, were given a room and board, if you like, in schools, empty schools, and so on. But most of them, of course, returned. Why 70,000 is important? 70,000 was slightly more than 10% of the Jewish community in Palestine. Jewish community in Palestine numbered 650,000 souls altogether. 70,000 of them, 10%, became refugees in the course of the 48 war. If that happened in Germany, 10% of Germans became refugees as a result of the war, you would have 8 million German refugees, which is, of course, as you understand, a large number. So 70,000 was a large number for the Jewish community in Palestine in 1948. It was an enormous refugee problem, but was solved. Most of the areas and settlements and so on taken over by the invading Arab armies in 1948 were reconquered by the Jews. The Jews were, Israel basically resettled them with their original inhabitants. Some places weren't reconquered, like the old city of Jerusalem and its Jewish quarter, but most were. They went back to their homes, and no Israeli refugee problem exists after 1948 in Israel. No Israeli refugee problem. It vanishes. The third refugee problem caused by the 48 war was the refugeedom of the Arab communities of the Arab world. Hundreds of thousands of Jews lived in Morocco, tens of thousands lived in Algeria, tens of thousands lived in Libya, tens of thousands lived in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Syria, 150,000 lived in Iraq, and I'm talking about Jews living in the Arab world before 1948. 100,000 or 70,000 lived in Yemen. All of these Jewish communities vanished as a result of the 48 war. All these Jews became refugees. The Jews of Yemen, the Jews of Iraq, the Jews of Egypt, the Jews of Morocco, etc., all became, over the course of the next 20 years, beginning in 1948, became refugees. First the Yemeni Jewish community, then the Iraqi Jewish community, and so on, all became refugees, being hounded out of those countries by the regimes and by the societies amid which they lived. The societies didn't want them there any longer. They saw the Jews as potential or actual collaborators with Israel, which had just defeated or was busy defeating the Palestinians and then defeating the Arab states and ejecting the Palestinians from their homes and lands in Palestine. And they saw the Jews as a subversive, potentially subversive, maybe actually subversive minority in their midst, and wanted to get rid of them. Most of them, incidentally, were not expelled. There wasn't an expulsion order. There wasn't an expulsion order to the Jewish communities to leave, but they were hounded out. They were killed in the streets. Some were killed in the streets of Cairo. Hundreds and thousands were incarcerated by the Egyptian and Iraqi regimes in the course of 1948. They were put in basically concentration camps in Egypt and Iraq. In Egypt in 1956, Colonel Nasser, who ruled Egypt, actually expelled the Jews remaining in Egypt in 1956, following the Sinai War. But in other countries, they weren't expelled formally, officially, but they were hounded out by the societies among whom they lived and by the governments under which they lived. And most of them ended up, of course, in Israel, especially the poorer ones. Say three-quarters, four-fifths of the Jewish communities in the Arab world ended up in Israel, where they were absorbed, perhaps not well, perhaps badly. In some cases, there was some discrimination. There was charges of discrimination among them, ill feeling when they arrived in Israel, and there weren't houses for them, there weren't good schools for them, there weren't jobs for many of them. Many of them were illiterate, of course. They couldn't actually fit into a modern society as Israel's Jewish society was in 49, as compared to the Atlas Mountain Jews from Morocco, for example. But in any case, they ended up in Israel, most of them, became Israeli citizens, eventually got houses, jobs, schools from the beginning, and ended up as Israeli citizens. A minority of the Jews from the Arab countries ended up in, and that's basically the middle class from Morocco, Algeria, Egypt, and so on, ended up in England and France mostly. There again, being absorbed, becoming citizens of France and England, and living happily ever after. So these Arab Jews, these communities of Arab Jews, vanished as a refugee society. That is, they were no longer refugees, and no longer was there a Jewish a refugee problem from the Arab world, of, you know, Jewish, from the Jewish communities there. And that refugee problem vanished. What remained was the Arab refugee problem, which, as I say, today numbers some 6 million souls. We can talk more about that, if you like, in the discussion. One last thing I wanted to go into was the peace processes in the course of the conflict. Initially, when the Zionist settlers came to Palestine in those first 30 years between 1882 and 1914, and in fact also for years afterwards, there was initial disinterest among the Zionist settlers for forging good relations or peaceful relations with their Arab neighbors. And they saw themselves as European settlers. They weren't actually colonists in the sense of European settlers in Algeria or Nairobi and Kenya or anywhere or in the Americas. They weren't agents of an imperial power. They were agents of their national movement. The Zionist national movement wanted a state in the land which had belonged to the Jews. That's how they saw themselves, a national liberation movement. That's how they saw themselves. But they were Europeans with the European attitude to the inhabitants of the land, the third world people who were the Arabs of Palestine. So they didn't take an interest in them. They didn't put out feelers. They didn't learn Arabic. They didn't want to know anything about the Arabs there. They wanted to establish their settlements, ultimately aiming at a Jewish state in Palestine, perhaps to turn all of Palestine into a Jewish state. In 1925, a group of intellectuals in Jerusalem, mostly, incidentally, German-Jewish, from German-Jewish origin, set up an association called Brit Shalom, a group of intellectuals who said, what we really need here is a binational state, not a Jewish state, not a Zionist state. And they were outliers of the Zionist movement. They had been Zionists coming to Palestine from Germany and elsewhere, supported by people like Martin Buber later, Gershom Scholem, big names, if you like, in the intelligentsia of Jewry in Palestine and sometimes outside of Palestine. The Zionist movement didn't like them because they weren't Zionists. They wanted to establish a binational state, not a Jewish state in Palestine, some sort of binational state with parity between the Jews and the Arabs ruling together. The problem was very few Jews accepted what they were preaching. Very few Jews in Palestine agreed with them. They wanted a Jewish state. That's what they'd come to Palestine for, not a binational state with Arabs as equal associates. On the other hand, or if you like, even more so, the Arabs of Palestine rejected what Brit Shalom offered. None of them, not one of them, signed up with Brit Shalom. Brit Shalom was trying to find Arab brothers for this association to produce eventually a binational state. There were no Arab takers at all. Among the Jews, there were hundreds perhaps who agreed. Among the Arabs, there was not one who wanted that. In the 1930s, the early 1930s, David Ben-Gurion, one of the heads of the Zionist movement, to emerge the most important head of the Zionist movement in Palestine, eventually the founder of the State of Israel, began holding some secret talks with Arab leaders. Among the most important of the Arab leaders he talked to, it was all very secret. He managed to talk Husseini, Haj Amin al-Husseini, didn't want to meet him, of course, but Musa al-Alami, one of the heads of the Arab National Movement, a British official, a senior British official in Palestine, talked to him. And Ben-Gurion said to him, we would like, basically, you should be favorable towards Zionism, because we Zionists want to bring prosperity and progress to all the inhabitants of the land, not the Jewish only, the Jewish settlers, but also the Arabs will enjoy our benefit, the benefit of our progress, money, expertise, and so on. And Musa al-Alami said to him, we'd rather remain a barren, that Palestine remain a barren land for the next 100 years. We don't want you here. That's what Musa al-Alami basically said to him. No Jewish state, we'd rather live in poverty for the next 100 years rather than accepting you. And this essentially was the Arab attitude to these very discreet peace feelers by Ben-Gurion, which may not have been completely sincere. He wasn't actually offering the Arabs a state. He was just saying, you will enjoy the prosperity generated by a Jewish state. In 1937, and here we have a crucial year in the peace processes between Israel and the Arabs, the first international body arrives in Palestine. In 1936, it arrives in November and issues its report, the Peel Commission, appointed by the British to find a solution to the Israeli, to the Arab revolt and the emergent or the existing Arab-Jewish conflict in Palestine, which is ruled by the British. They send this Peel Commission, and the Peel Commission issues its report in July, in which they make a proposal how to resolve this, the Jewish-Arab conflict in Palestine. And the Peel Commission says partition and two states, which will remain to this day what the West or the international community still supports, the idea of a partition of Palestine into two states. The Peel Commission puts it on the table for the first time, July 1937. They say two states, the Jews getting 20% of Palestine, slightly less maybe, the Arabs getting most of the remainder with a British enclave under continued British control in Jerusalem and Bethlehem and a corridor to the sea. That's what the Peel Commission proposes. Its basic proposal, a two-state solution, partition of Palestine. And the Arabs reject it. The Jews reluctantly accept the concept of a two-state solution. They don't particularly like the 17% they're being offered. They want slightly more. But at least they accept the idea, the principle of partition as a solution to the conflict ongoing in Palestine. The Arabs say no completely. It's not a matter of percentages. We don't want a Jewish state in any part of Palestine. 5%, 10%, 20%, it doesn't matter. We don't want them there. Here. And that's what happens in 1937. 1947, the UN General Assembly regurgitates or repeats, echoes the Peel Commission report, this time giving the Jews more of Palestine in the partition resolution that the United Nations General Assembly proposes, November 1947. The Jews accept the proposal. The Arabs of Palestine reject it, supported by the Arab states and the Muslim states in the General Assembly. They all vote against. And the UN General Assembly partition plan does actually receive the majority vote, 33 to 13, with 10 abstentions. But the Palestinians say no, and the Palestinian Arabs begin their hostilities against the Jews, and the Arab states eventually, well, they support them with money, arms, some volunteers, and eventually they themselves, when the Palestinian militias are defeated, they invade as well in May, as I said, 1948, and join the battle against the Jewish state. The peace process in some way is renewed clandestinely by Abdullah, the king of Jordan, who would rather have a Jewish state as his neighbor rather than an Arab state led by Husseini. He hates Husseini. He sees the Palestinian Arabs as rivals for territory. He wants at least part of Palestine, Abdullah, and in his secret negotiations with the Jews. He actually conquers the West Bank and East Jerusalem in the course of the 48 war, and then they have clandestine peace talks between Jordan and Israel for the next 2-3 years. And in his eyes, the Jews are not being generous enough. They don't offer enough in terms of what the Jordanians are requesting, which is more land and a refugee return. That is, that he wouldn't have to take care of all these refugees who've poured into Transjordan. They would go back to Palestine. He wants Lydda and Ramle as a part of his territorial acquisitions as a result of a peace treaty. Israel says no. But in general, I don't think these negotiations between Israel and Jordan would have gotten anywhere, even if he'd really accepted them. And his government was composed, his cabinet was composed of ministers who were Palestinian, who rejected the idea completely. But he wouldn't have been able to sign a peace treaty with Israel because the Arab world would have been against him, united against Israel, which had just delivered a grievous, humiliating blow to the Arab world. They would never have countenanced him stepping aside and making peace with the Jews. It wouldn't have happened. In any case, a Palestinian gunman shoots Abdullah dead at the entrance to the Al-Aqsa Mosque in 1951, and from that point on, there is no peace between Israel and Jordan, no continued negotiations. There were, incidentally, some other secret negotiations between Israel and Syria in 1949, between Israel and the Egyptians in 1949, 50, 51, even a bit later with Nasser's regime, which took power in 1952 in Egypt. But nothing came of all of these, and there was no peace made between Israel and those Arab states which had fought against it during the war. And the Arab world maintained, basically, there was non-belligerence agreed to between the Arab states around Israel and Israel in armistice agreement signed in 1949. But there was under that a low-level conflict between Israeli Arab and usually Palestinian guerrillas or terrorists, whatever you want to call them, and occasional clashes between the Israeli and Egyptian and Syrian and Jordanian armies during those years until 1967, but there was no peace. 1967, when Israel acquired the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, the East Jerusalem, the Sinai Peninsula, and the Golan Heights in the Six-Day War, a prospect of peace opened up again. Why? Because Israel now held territory which was important for the Arab states to retrieve. The Syrians wanted the Golan Heights back. The Egyptians wanted the Sinai Peninsula. Jordan wanted the West Bank. So the Israel had something it could deliver apart from its own territory, which some Arab states were demanding for peace. They had some cards they could actually exchange for peace. And in fact, the Israeli cabinet on the 19th of June, 1967, 10 days after the Six-Day Wars, 9 days after the Six-Day War ended, on the 19th of June, 1967, the Israeli cabinet secretly resolved to return return the Golan Heights to Syria in exchange for peace with Syria if it is demilitarized, and to return the Sinai Peninsula to the Egyptians, demilitarized, if the Egyptians agreed to make peace with Israel. Except that it's not clear that these offers made by the Israeli cabinet resolution were ever actually transmitted to Cairo and Damascus in real time and properly. But in any case, within months, in September 1967, the Arab League leaders met in Khartoum, September 1967, and said no to negotiations, unanimously said no to negotiations, no to recognition of Israel, no to peace with Israel. The famous three no's of Khartoum. And from that point on, it appeared that the Six-Day War, the benefits from Israel's point of view of the Six-Day War of territory which could be exchanged for peace, seemed to die. But that it died for only 6 years, that option. Because 1973, you have the last of the Israeli-Arab wars, Israel versus Egypt and Syria, which attacked it. And that war, because in some ways it restored Arab honor, the humiliation of 67 was in some way neutralized by the initial Arab successes in that war, and Egypt was willing to make peace. It appears also that Egypt was willing to make peace before 1973, but Israel's Golda Meir prime minister wasn't particularly interested in giving back the Sinai in exchange for peace. But after the 73 war, with great Israeli losses, the Israeli government changed its view, and a peace process was initiated by the Egyptian president, who had launched the 73 war and then made a peace offer. And by 1979, under American auspices, Israel and Egypt made peace, which is what I described before. Eventually, there is Israeli peace with Egypt. Eventually, this is followed in some ways by the Oslo Accords, the Oslo process with the Palestinians, which didn't really mature into peace. And eventually, we have the Israeli-Jordanian peace in 1994, and the normalization of relations between Israel and the participants of the Abraham Accords in 2020-2021. And that's where we are today, basically. After the Palestinians have said no in 2000, as I said, and in 2008, to the offer by Israel of a two-state solution at Camp David in July 2000, by the Clinton parameters in December 2000, and by Olmert to Abbas in 2008. And that's where we are today. That's all I have to say.
eine Produktion von MENA Watch, dem unabhängigen Nahost-Think-Tank. Auf unserer Website finden Sie täglich aktuelle Informationen und Analysen. Besuchen Sie uns.